welcome to Chris Carey.
Hey, thank you.
Can you tell him, like, totally dorked out on this
thing?
Well,
that's okay. I think it's good for people to dork out on music. Today, for the classic pick, I decided we'd go with The Unforgettable Fire, which actually came out October 1984, so 35 years ago this album came out. If you're not feeling old enough, you can now.
I'm feeling pretty old, but I'm also feeling young listening to it. I swear to God, it brought me back to like sixth grade. And
yeah, I was in high school, but I totally remember riding. I was not old enough to drive, and I remember riding to school in a 1981 Ford Fairmont listening to this album.
Nice.
Yeah, so, you know, U2, they were formed in Dublin, Ireland in 1976. U2's been a band since, you know, for over 40 years. And I think I've talked about this about 3 years ago. I did another U2 review, and I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a band that's been together as long as they have that's all the same members. I mean, there's been bands that have been together longer than U2, but oftentimes they have one or several member changes. And I think that's pretty cool, just that the fact that these guys have been friends since high school and still have the same band. You know, they were initially pretty much rooted in just post-punk, and it kind of evolved, have a lot more atmospheric qualities in what they did. They always, you know, they always kind of had this anthemic, epic kind of, you know, undercurrent in everything they did, oftentimes with a focus on socio-political themes. And, you know, they did that from the get-go, but they continued to do that throughout their entire lifespan. Prior to this album, they released War in 1983. They always were pretty successful even from the beginning, but War kind of put them over the top. I mean, War sold over 10 million copies worldwide. And, you know, as indie albums go, I mean, they were considered an indie band back then. That's about as big as you can get.
And it was huge in the States. I mean, they toured, and I mean, it was really pivotal.
It was it's still a great record. And so, you know, going into this, I mean, and that record was probably their hardest rocking record, definitely to that date, and arguably their hardest rocking record they ever put out. And at the time, they were worried about, you know, Island Records was pushing them to do that more, and U2 didn't want to become another just rock band. And they had been working with Steve Lillywhite on their first three records, who was a great producer, did a lot of stuff in the 80s and with other post-punk bands. But so they wanted to do something different. And Larry Mullins in particular had been listening a lot to Brian Eno's later 70s and early 80s ambient work. And he convinced the band to work with Brian Eno. And you know, Brian Eno, you know, as for those of you, I'm sure most people have at least heard Eno's name, but he's kind of a monster in the development of modern rock and indie rock. You know, aside from being in Roxy Music and having several solo glam art rock albums in the mid 70s, he's also kind of he's kind of the person who developed ambient music as a subgenre. And he's one of the early pioneers of electronica. He's worked with tons of amazing acts aside from U2, most notably. He kind of worked with David Bowie on what's called the Berlin Trilogy, which the albums Low and Heroes and Lodger, which are great, great records. He also produced several Talking Heads albums, which are amazing too. They're all, so he's kind of a big deal. And Brian Eno is, he had been working with, at the time, a younger producer who's become kind of a monster in his own right, Daniel Lanois. At the time, Daniel Lanois was an engineer with Brian Eno on a lot of different things. And he brought him along to, and at first, I think, you know, Lanois was just going to be an engineer on this album, and he ended up being a co-producer with Brian Eno. But Lanois, everything he's always done has had a very atmospheric kind of vibe to it, as well as a lot of records that Brian Eno has produced. So they brought this kind of atmospheric kind of sound, which has now become, you know, kind of synonymous with what U2 did. But prior to Unforgettable Fire, you really don't hear that in their music quite so much. And even after Brian Eno and Daniel Lanois didn't work with U2 anymore, that kind of vibe stuck with them. So, I mean, you could, you know, Eno and And Lanois really did a lot with U2's development, even after they left. Of course, I mean, on top of Unforgettable Fire, they also worked with their two other biggest records, which was, you know, which was Joshua Tree and Octoon Baby, which, you know, the fact that they, those two produced all three of these albums is pretty significant. You know, recording it, that took place in 1984, this record, it sounds kind of mysterious and, you know, almost like a fairy tale at points. And it sounds like it could be recorded in a castle, and that's because it was. It was recorded in Slane Castle, which was just outside of Dublin, a 17th century castle, which was in great shape. I think that people actually lived there, and they rented it out. And originally, they were going to record the whole album in the ballroom of the castle, but then they found out that the ballroom had too much national reverberation, and so it was almost too echoey. Mm-hmm. And they ended up moving into the library for many tracks, which was pretty spacious, but not quite as spacious. And the books worked as sound absorption. And so most of this album was recorded in a castle's library, which is pretty cool.
That is so cool. And of note, I was in Ireland this summer, drove very nearby that castle, and it is very nearby where my grandfather is from in Ireland.
Oh, that's cool.
I looked it up on the
map.
You should
do 23andMe. Maybe you're related to one or more of the people, you know, involved in this album. You know, and then it was recorded mostly there. And then they did some finishing and mixing work at a studio in Dublin. They worked really long hours. They would get up and start working at 9 or 10 and then work past 1 a.m. And they did that for almost a month straight on this record. The name of I didn't know this, and the name of the album actually came from a art exhibit, which was a bunch of Japanese artists that had done paintings and drawings, and they were all survivors of the atomic bomb blasts in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
I think that is a huge point about this album, and also speaks to how art inspires music.
Yeah.
When I saw that, I was like, wow, that is so fascinating. They went to that museum on the war tour.
Yeah. It was the Peace Museum in Chicago.
Yeah.
And this was actually the very first exhibit at that museum. And it really inspired them. And so, and then the cover art is another 17th century Irish castle, but it's located more in central Ireland, and it's in somewhat of disrepair. But the band members all really liked the fact that it had all the ivy over it, and it kind of seemed like mystical, King Arthur kind of vibe to it. Commercially, this record, just based on the sales of the earlier records, was kind of destined to do really well, and it did. At this point, it didn't sell quite as much as War did, but almost as many. It sold over 8 million worldwide, and it ended up number one on the charts in the UK, Australia, and New Zealand. It never got that high. It got to 12 on the Billboard Top 200 in the US, but it was multi-platinum in several countries, you know, hugely successful. Critically, it was there was a few detractors for the most part when it came out. Almost everybody thought it was a pretty good record, and over the years it's grown in stature, and a lot of people point to this as a real pivotal point. And I mean, it really is, when they switched from working with Steve Lillywhite to Lanois and Eno, that they really did kind of develop the sound that I think is kind of the synonymous kind of stereotypical U2 sound.
Yeah, you set that up really, really well. And I immediately went to like 4th of July and how it's sort of creepy and ambient and mysterious. And
yeah, and I can't even and what's funny and what's really interesting about what Eno and Lanois did with those atmospherics, and what you hear with what they did on those three albums that they all worked together, like, I can't even place it, but I've heard so many soundtracks to TV shows and movies that have that same sort of vibe that Lanois and Eno developed. And so, you know, I mean, this sound they kind of helped develop with U2 spilled over into a lot of other things. I mean, these last two U2 albums in the 80s and Octoon Baby in the 1991, I think influenced a lot even outside of the music world. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And, you know, U2, I know sometimes, which I don't get, but some of the younger people out there sometimes kind of you know, Pasha, U2, but they are pretty amazing. They influenced a ton of stuff. They had over 14 studio albums. They have sold over 170 million records worldwide. One of the largest selling, you know, bands in all time of all time. They've won 22 Grammys, which I think is more than even, you know, other huge groups have done. You know, there's all the other super groups. I don't think any other group has won more Grammys than U2, you know, and they also, interesting, they have the highest grossing tour of all time. Granted, it was a tour that lasted for, you know, over a year.
The forever tour.
Yeah, yeah, but it did. It grossed $736 million. Over 7 million people attended the concerts, which is pretty crazy.
And Bono's done a lot of really wonderful politically active work and charity work and
tons of stuff, particularly for Amnesty International.
Yes.
Yeah, he's done a ton of stuff.
Thank you so much for coming in, Chris. Chris is talking to us about the classic pick of the week here on KXCI. And is there anything else you want to share with us?
Yeah, I just want to talk a little bit about the track we're going to play here in a minute is Bad, the song Bad, which is kind of an important song for you two on many levels. I think it, in an abstract way, it dealt with addiction going on that was going on. It was really bad in the early 80s in the UK and Ireland both. But it was also an important song because this was the last song in their set at the Live Aid concert in 1985. And I honestly think that, you know, along with Queen's performance and U2's performance at Live Aid in 1985 were kind of the two big performances. And they finished their set with a 12-minute version of this song, which also included he included lyrics from a couple of Rolling Stones songs. I think Ruby Tuesday and Sympathy for the Devil, as well as a couple of Lou Reed songs, Satellite of Love and what was the other one? Walk on the Wild Side, yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful. And I'm going to put a little link to Making of the Unforgettable Fire, which if you're a total U2 nerd, you're going to want to watch it. It's like a half an hour little making of video, and it's actually pretty cool.
It is pretty cool.
Yeah. Thanks so much for coming in, Chris, and for your work and research.
Well, thanks for having me.